Bob Harrod had lived quite a life, coming from the rural backwoods town of McFall, Missouri, to the sun and warmth of Southern California. At 80 years old, he'd been just about everywhere, though the passing of his wife darkened his world. It was shortly after that terrible tragedy that something completely unexpected happened. Bob's first love called him out of the blue. The couple had been engaged 59 years earlier, but had separated when Bob joined the Marines. Having also lost her spouse, Fontelle Heater was excited to reconnect with Bob, and the feeling was mutual. After many long conversations, Bob invited Fontelle to California. The visit would go so well that by the time it was over, Bob and Fontelle would be married. Needing to return home to Missouri to gather her belongings, Fontelle left California, planning to return on their one-month anniversary of July 29th. Unfortunately, Bob would disappear just 2 days prior. Under what can only be described as extremely suspicious circumstances, the 80-year-old vanished from inside of his home on the morning of July 27th, 2009. Nothing was missing from the home except Bob's wallet and keys. His car was still parked in the driveway, and there was no sign of a struggle. Fingers were pointed in all directions, at the family, at Fontelle, at former acquaintances. It wasn't until investigators discovered that Bob, who had lived a humble life, had an estimated value of $5 million. Could Bob have been murdered for his wealth? And if so, who sat to benefit the most from his disappearance? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 77, The Disappearance of Bob Harrod. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the 2009 disappearance of Bob Harrod from Southern California. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at traceevpod, on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. Today we examine the mysterious circumstances surrounding Bob Harrod. It's a strange case with little evidence and 5 million motives. This is Episode 77, The Disappearance of Bob Harrod. Robert Merle Harrod was born on June 1st, 1928. Bob, as most people referred to him, grew up in McFall, Missouri during the first half of the century. At the time Bob lived there, the population was listed as being just over 400 residents, while today, it's less than 100 residents. While the city of McFall wasn't exactly a bustling metropolis, it did provide locals with a tight-knit community in the way that only small towns can. Not a great deal of Bob's past has made its way into the public record, but specific important details are known. In the spring of 1949, Fontelle Heater was asked to help a friend of her sister's. The young woman wanted to go on a blind date, but she needed someone to accompany her date's friend. Fontelle, 15 at the time, agreed to go along, and her date would be Bob Harrod. When asked about their first encounter, Fontelle later recalled, quote, "When I first met him, I looked into his eyes, right straight into his soul, and he just seemed like a good person. I just felt he was a good man. end quote. While their meeting had been completely due to circumstance and considered a random encounter, it would be the first spark in what would become a vehement flame. Their relationship developed quickly, and the two became inseparable. To this day, Fontel maintains old photos of the two. As they continued to bond, the calendar rolled around to January of 1950, and Bob, 21 at the time, shared his true feelings with Fontel. Wanting to spend the rest of his life with the young woman, Bob proposed with a diamond ring and Fontel accepted. The two had a life to build together, a future to plan, but before long, all of that would change. Bob joined the Marine Corps Reserves in the summer of 1950 and was ordered to report to Camp Pendleton in Southern California. The news was concerning to Fontel, but she and Bob were devoted to one another and believed that, despite the distance, they'd be able to make it work. When Bob finally did leave to go out west, Fontel rode along with him for a period of time, traveling 130 miles with her fiancé until they were forced to part ways. While Bob was at Camp Pendleton, Fontel wrote and wrote and wrote. She sent letter after letter out west, sharing every detail of her hopes and dreams with her future husband. At the time, Bob was serving as a cook at the camp, and according to Fontel, he was staying with an older woman who provided rooms. Despite her exhaustive efforts and letters to Bob, many of the letters were returned unopened. In a later interview, Fontel speculated that the woman with whom Bob was rooming wanted the young man to marry her niece, and so she may have been intercepting the letters and returning them before Bob could see them. Either way, it seemed apparent that the distance was doing its job of separating the two, and while the love may still have been there, it just wasn't working out logistically. In what would be his final communication with Fontel, Bob confessed his concern about his safety. Were he to be sent into combat, he was unsure what his chances were of surviving, and he explained to Fontel that he did not want her to hold to a commitment that he might not be able to fulfill. The two went their separate ways. A few years later, in 1953, Fontel fell in love with another man and was married, though this marriage wouldn't last. It would be her second marriage that would go the distance, and while Fontel had moved on, she'd never forgotten about Bob, who was also moving on with his life. In 1951, Bob fell in love and married a young woman named Georgia, and the two would remain married for the next 57 years. During the course of their marriage, the couple would have three children, all daughters, Roberta, Julie, and Paula. For Bob, the future was locked in place, and he was focused on spending the rest of his life as a father and husband. Fontel, hearing of Bob's marriage, made the choice to never contact him again. She didn't want to cause any problems with his new life. Bob did well for himself and his family. A frugal man, likely due to his upbringing in the aftermath of the Great Depression, he knew how to save money. Bob worked several jobs before becoming a contract manager. Beyond the income from his career, Bob would invest in real estate, coming to own several properties and selling others for profit. Over a lifetime, Bob was able to accumulate a great deal of wealth that even those closest to him, including his own children, didn't have a full grasp of. This was partially due to Bob's strict privacy, in that he rarely, if ever, discussed financial or personal matters with anyone, even his children. It was also due somewhat to his modest lifestyle. Despite his wealth, Bob and Georgia lived in a normal home, decorated with the basics, but nothing extravagant. He was never a person who was obsessed over the material aspects of life, and found far greater comfort in the companionship of his wife and the quiet station of his home. In 2002, Bob and Georgia would find Placentia, California, and it became home. Located in northern Orange County, Placentia is quite the contrast to his original town of McFall, boasting more than 50,000 residents and over 6 square miles. It was a good place to settle down, known specifically as an area with quiet, calm neighborhoods and a median household income of $75,000. It worked wonderfully for Bob, who, for the most part, kept to himself. He was a polite man and would certainly speak with neighbors and strangers that he ran into, but he wasn't exceedingly outgoing and definitely wasn't the kind of guy you'd expect to show up on your doorstep just looking to chat. Bob would become even more withdrawn as things in his life began to take a tragic turn. His beloved wife, Georgia, became ill, and Bob spent every available moment taking care of her. Friends and neighbors later commented on the fact that, during this time, they rarely saw Bob unless it was to take his wife to doctors or to run out for small errands. Bob would eventually have a chairlift installed in the home to make it easier for Georgia to maneuver. Unfortunately, she would lose her battle and pass away in 2008. To say Bob was devastated would be a dramatic understatement. As is to be expected when someone loses their partner after so many years together, Bob entered a deep depression, and according to his family, he began losing weight quickly. Heartbroken and without the desire to do more, Bob stopped eating and would often break down into tears, which was concerning for his family, who knew him as the kind of man who didn't show that kind of emotion. Things would shift for Bob, though, in a way which both friends and family would find troubling. For years, Bob and Georgia had gone to the same barber shop and had their hair worked on by a woman in her mid-40s named Josie. Following Georgia's passing, Josie slowly became more and more involved in Bob's life. The much younger woman seemed to have her eyes on the now 80-year-old Bob. Bob's daughters felt that Josie was preying on their father, digging her claws in and seeking only to use him for his money. They recounted the day that they set sail to spread their mother's ashes at sea, and how Josie had come along to accompany Bob, who appeared to have found comfort in the younger woman. Bob was heartbroken, depressed, and desperately did not want to be alone. It wouldn't have been difficult for anyone to have inserted themselves into his life at that time. The relationship between Bob and Josie would be short-lived. It wasn't long before the two would go their separate ways, but not before Bob had given Josie several expensive gifts and even more expensive loans. According to his daughters, that was extremely out of character for their father. Bob hardly ever loaned money, and if he did, it was almost always to a family member. For Bob, it was a business matter, and he didn't allow personal feelings to interfere. When loaning money to family members, Bob would arrange a date by which the money had to be paid back and interest would be involved in that transaction. So it was startling when his daughters found out that, over the course of several months, Bob had loaned Josie a total of $86,000. According to his daughters, a call was placed to social services, who came to visit and speak with Bob. Reportedly, Bob acknowledged that Josie had abused him financially, but that he didn't want to pursue any charges. With his relationship with Josie having ended, Bob began to wonder about a long-lost love from his youth. In the interest of perhaps reconnecting or simply discovering what became of the first woman he ever loved, Bob spoke with his daughter Paula about the possibility of locating her. Paula would later explain, quote, "Dad first mentioned Fontelle to me in December of 2008. He had told me they were engaged some 59 years previously when they both lived in Missouri." End quote. Paula went online in hopes of locating Fontelle, but it was a fruitless effort. The assumption was that Fontelle had likely been married at some point in time, and without knowing her current last name, all efforts to find her were hindered from the get-go. While Bob was upset, he understood. But what he could never imagine was that while he was looking for Fontelle, she was beginning to look for him. The situation between Bob and his daughters entered a negative space following clashes and concerns over several issues. The relationship with Josie had been one situation his family found difficult to accept, and they attempted to tell Bob that he was being used. But what really drove a wedge between father and daughters was money. When Georgia had been alive back in 1995, a trust had been established which named the three daughters as the beneficiaries. However, after Georgia had passed, there was a growing concern that Bob was not keeping up with his legal requirements in connection with that trust. Bob was supposed to keep his family updated on the status of the trust and provide them with official documents to back up those statements, but he had failed to do so, and in response, his family drafted a formal letter. The letter specified that Bob hadn't been living up to his responsibilities and that he was legally bound to provide his family with this information. In response, Bob became exceedingly upset and hurt by all of it. It was during this time that Bob began to distance himself from his family, telling them he wanted some time alone. He told them not to call, not to visit, and to just leave him alone. For him, it was difficult, struggling with accepting the loss of his wife while feeling overwhelmed by all of the things he needed to do, but just didn't have the drive or energy to keep up with. For the next 6 months, he would have extremely limited, if any, contact with his daughters. It was during this 6 month period of time that Bob would be caught delightfully off guard by a phone call from the past. Fontelle had always wondered what became of the man she first was engaged to. When her own husband passed away in 2006, she found it difficult to find her place in the world. The absence of her husband felt incredibly strong, and she couldn't seem to find enough to do to keep her days busy. Much like Bob had done some months earlier, Fontelle turned to her daughter and asked if she might be able to locate him. Unlike with Bob, Fontelle's daughter found the task quite easy. When she located an 80-year-old man named Bob Harrod, it seemed highly unlikely this wouldn't be the one she had been seeking. Dialing the number, she placed the phone in Fontelle's hand before she had time to hesitate. On the other end of the line, a man answered, and Fontelle asked if he was the same Bob who had grown up in McFall, Missouri. When Bob confirmed that information and asked who was calling, his heart skipped a beat at the answer. From that day forward, Bob and Fontelle would speak on the phone every day, usually twice, once in the morning and once in the evening. It had been 59 years since they'd spoken, and they had a lot to catch up on. For Bob, it was comforting and exciting to reconnect with his old flame, to feel that the sparks were still there. Fontelle was able to provide him with comfort, while he was able to do the same for her. These two people, who had once loved each other, had been through a lot and lost their spouses, only to find one another again. It wouldn't be long before Bob propositioned Fontelle with the possibility of coming out to California for a visit. They arranged for her to fly out in June of 2009, and both of them were extremely excited. Fontelle wore a bright pink jacket in order to attract Bob's attention at the airport, but when he laid his eyes on her, he later said he knew immediately that it was her. Fontelle later commented about the fact that while he had gone bald over the years, she could still see that sparkle in his eyes that she had first seen when they were teenagers. Standing there in a Hawaiian patterned shirt, shorts, and a pair of white loafers, Bob embraced Fontelle and the two quickly hurried over to his car and began the drive home. Upon arrival, they brewed coffee, sat at the table, and chatted as though no time had passed. It was during this time that Bob noticed for the first time that Fontelle was wearing the engagement ring he'd given her. She'd kept it for nearly 60 years, having never forgotten her desire to marry him. For the next few days, the two were inseparable, spending every waking moment together. They went out to dinner, for drives, and Bob introduced her to his friends and even his daughters, despite the rift. According to everyone, Fontelle seemed like a nice, polite, and kind woman, and Bob was exuberated to be in her company. Not wanting her to leave quite yet, Bob asked Fontelle to extend her stay, and she did, moving her departure date to July 7th. But Bob had another date in mind. After spending just 6 days together, Bob asked Fontelle what he would have to do to get her to stay in California, and the 73-year-old replied that the only way she'd move in is if they were married. Without missing a beat, Bob proposed and Fontelle accepted. Not long after, they went down to the local Sam's Club perusing the jewelry counter. When all was said and done, the two had purchased rings. Bob would wear a gold band while Fontelle would sport a white gold band. Following the purchase of the rings, the next step was to head down to town hall to fill out the appropriate paperwork. While Bob was excited, his family was concerned things might be moving a little too quickly. Bob's daughter, Roberta, later explained, quote, "We want our dad to be happy, but at the same time, you know, we warned him to just take your time, get to know this person. You've been away from this person more of your life than you ever spent with her. Do you really know each other?" But their minds had obviously been made up, and they were going to get married. End quote. And so they did. On June 29th, Bob and Fontel completed the necessary paperwork. At that moment, the woman behind the desk smiled at the couple and asked them if they wanted to get married right that minute. Excited about the proposition, they agreed and were officially married that day. When Bob's daughters found out, they were happy for their father, but also concerned about what this would change in their lives. Reportedly, Bob also reached out to Josie at this time, the woman he'd spent time with and loaned all that money to, and requested that she pay back what she owed him. The newlyweds returned home and began making plans. They decided that on July 7th, Fontel would return home to Missouri, at which time she'd begin packing her things, and then she would fly back out to California on July 29th, the date of their one-month anniversary, and they would officially move in together and begin the life they'd put on hold for 60 years. Bob had things he needed to accomplish as well, including adding Fontel's name to bank accounts and even the house. On the day Fontel left town, a local news station sent a reporter out to cover the story of this long-lost love. When asked about Fontel, Bob replied, quote, "When she talked, I knew it was her. I could just tell by her voice, and that spark was still there. I just wanted to hold her forever." End quote. While Fontel was making her arrangements to move, Bob decided he wanted to end the rift between he and his daughters. He reached out and arranged a family meeting, which would take place on Sunday, July 26th. According to everyone involved, it wasn't exactly a smooth gathering. He called the meeting to update them on the trust and get things back in order, but when they had questions, he didn't seem eager to answer them. Roberta later stated, quote, "He was required by law to provide certain reporting, and he hadn't done that yet. He didn't put out all the information on the table that he had told us we were being given, and so I had some questions for him, and he got testy." End quote. Allegedly, Bob became flustered at the questions, and then it was noticed that certain documents were missing. Angry and upset, Bob explained he didn't know where the papers were, and as things heated up, his daughter Julie was able to locate them, and things settled down. According to his daughters, Bob calmed down when everything had been settled and the group of them spent the time together as a family. They sat on the couch, talked, and joked. They reminisced about the past and about Bob's new love life. By all accounts, the meeting had gotten a little tense, but in the end, everything was fine. Well, perhaps not all accounts. Fontel tells the story a little differently. According to her, when she spoke with Bob later that evening and asked how the meeting had gone, he expressed that he was still very angry and hurt about what had transpired. Unlike the statements of his daughters, Fontel claims the major conflict had nothing to do with the trust and everything to do with her. Bob had allegedly told his children of his plans to add his new wife's name to his bank accounts, the house, and the estate. While Bob's daughters deny this and have gone on to claim that Fontel's name never came up in the conversation, we have two very different sides of the argument presented without the ability to truly know what exactly happened. What we do know, however, beyond the shadow of a doubt, is that less than 24 hours after this family meeting, Bob Harrod would disappear. Monday, July 27th began as a normal day. Bob had plans in place, looking to complete getting the house ready for Fontel's arrival 2 days later. He'd made several arrangements in advance. One was with his son-in-law, Jeff Michaels, who was married to his daughter Julie, and he'd asked him to come by and perform some maintenance work around the house. The other was with his housekeeper of 10 years, Agnes, who normally came on Tuesdays, but this week would come on Monday instead. Jeff pulled up to the home at approximately 9:30 a.m. and stated that Bob was there when he arrived. Sometime before 10 a.m., Jeff is reported to have left the home and gone down to a local CVS drugstore where he made a small purchase. Jeff returned shortly thereafter and continued working in the home. Multiple calls came into the house that day, which Bob answered. One was believed to have been with Agnes to arrange what time she would be coming over to clean. Roberta also claims to have called sometime between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m., during which time she spoke to her father and heard her brother-in-law, Jeff, mentioned that he needed to go to the hardware store. According to Jeff, he again left the home at 2:30 p.m., this time to go to Home Depot for supplies, which was later confirmed by receipts and surveillance footage, but this will be the last time anyone can confirm seeing Bob. There are two Home Depots within 3 miles of Bob's home, and each trip is less than 10 minutes. The timestamp on receipt shows Jeff is paying for his purchase at 3:04. Agnes arrived at the home, but found it vacant. Bob's car, a white Toyota Camry, sat in the driveway, but there's no response when she knocked on the door. According to Agnes, Bob was almost always home when she arrived to clean, but on the rare occasions when he wasn't, he would let her know in advance and then would leave a key for her in the mailbox. When Agnes checked, no key had been left, and for the first time in her 10 years of working for Bob, she wasn't able to get into the house. Unsure of what to do, and assuming Bob may have just gone to a neighbor's quickly, she sat down and waited. I should note that there's a great deal of discrepancies with the official timeline. In some places, it's reported that Agnes's time of arrival was 3:15 p.m., whereas in other media, that time is actually reported closer to 12 p.m. This is an important detail, as we know that Jeff left to go to Home Depot sometime between 2:30 and 3, and both he and Agnes have acknowledged that he found her waiting outside of the house on his return. However, if her arrival time is closer to 12 p.m., that would imply that Jeff had left the house an additional time, which is unaccounted for. Agnes, though, will later report leaving after 6 p.m., after having spent approximately 3 hours cleaning, which seems to agree with the 3:15 p.m. timeline. Either way, when Jeff arrived back at the house, Agnes has stated that he seemed thrown off by her presence. Jeff reportedly asked her if she was supposed to be there that day, which she confirmed. Thinking it possible that Bob may have taken a nap, Jeff and Agnes decided to enter the home quietly through the back door. According to Agnes, from the time she entered the home, she had a feeling she just couldn't shake that something was wrong. There was an eerie stillness about the house, and while she'd been coming there for years, this was the first time she felt truly uncomfortable. She has since stated that, while preparing to clean the house, she spoke with Jeff and requested that he go upstairs and make sure everything was okay. She couldn't quite describe it, but Agnes explained later that she was fearful that if she went upstairs, she might find something she didn't want to see. It seemed apparent that Agnes was genuinely concerned that Bob may have been injured or perhaps died, and she didn't want to walk into what could be a disturbing scene. Agnes has since explained that when Jeff went upstairs, she expected him to just take a quick look around and let her know that the coast was clear, but to her surprise, Jeff was upstairs for several minutes without saying anything. At the time, she thought this must have meant something was wrong, and so she called out to him, but he responded that everything seemed to be fine and Bob wasn't in the house. He supposedly suggested the possibility that Bob may have gone to visit a neighbor. Still feeling strange about the situation, Agnes proceeded upstairs to get on with her cleaning. It's at this time that Agnes entered the bedroom and was both confused and disturbed by what she saw. Bob's bed was a mess, looking as though he'd gotten up, thrown the covers off, and left the room quickly. While this doesn't seem like a big deal, Agnes says that in all of her years working for Bob, she never once found the bed unmade, stating, quote, "It was just so out of character for him to not make the bed. It was very strange," end quote. Around 6 p.m., Jeff finally finished working in the bathroom and left the home. Agnes finished up her cleaning shortly after and also left. She'd never seen Bob gone without notice, nor for this long without telling someone where he had gone to, and she was still concerned. Less than 2 hours later, around 8 p.m., Fontel will make her normal call to Bob, but this time, he doesn't pick up. At first, she assumed he may have needed to run an errand, and so she waited and called back, but again received no answer. For the next few hours, Fontel called every 20 to 30 minutes, and with each unanswered call, she grew more and more concerned. Bob's daughter, Julie, Jeff's wife, also says she called the house that night and failed to receive an answer. In response to this, Julie called her sisters, and they all decided to contact the police to do a welfare check. Local police arrived at the home at approximately 9:32 p.m., and found Bob's car in the driveway, secure with no signs of trouble. The home appeared to be in good condition, there were no signs or indications of a crime or a struggle anywhere, and so they reported back to the family that while Bob did not appear to be home, they saw nothing which would suggest that they should be overly concerned. While that was good news, it was also concerning, as the 81-year-old rarely went anywhere for this long without calling someone. As midnight approached, Fontelle became so concerned she decided to call one of Bob's daughters. But around that same time, she received a call from Julie, who explained that they didn't know where her father was. Fontelle, worried about what may have happened, decided to call the Placentia Police Department herself, and as Bob's wife, filed an official missing persons report. The next day, Tuesday, July 28th, the Placentia Police Department officially began their investigation into Bob's disappearance. Their first step was to speak with family members and those who had last seen Bob. They spoke with Jeff, who was officially the last person to see him. According to Jeff, Bob was present in the home that morning, but after he returned from the store, Bob was gone. Jeff provided authorities with receipts to verify his story, and while they do in fact confirm that he went to the store, the exact time of Bob's disappearance is unknown, so all the receipts truly do is show that Jeff went to a store that day, not that he has a solid alibi. In response to the interview with Jeff, authorities requested permission to sweep his vehicle for forensic evidence, which he granted. Despite a thorough and exhaustive search of Jeff's truck, combing over every inch of it, no evidence was found to suggest that, had something happened to Bob, that he had ever been in that truck. There were no signs of blood found in the truck or in the bed of the truck. There was absolutely nothing to connect Bob's disappearance to Jeff or his truck. During questioning, though, Jeff did offer a possible suspect. According to him, on the day of Bob's disappearance, at least once and possibly twice, he witnessed an SUV driving slowly down the road. It was Jeff's contention that he recognized the SUV as belonging to Bob's former girlfriend, Josie. After being given this information, authorities did investigate into the possibility that Josie could have been involved. Contacting her, she willingly came down to the police station for questioning. According to investigators, Josie was not only fully honest and open about the fact that she had borrowed money from Bob, but also that she hadn't paid much of it back. She reportedly didn't try to hide anything during the interview, was not evasive in her answers, and was adamant that she had not driven down Bob's road that day. She was also able to provide authorities with an alibi for her whereabouts on the day of Bob's disappearance, and the alibi was confirmed. Police have said it's somewhat unlikely Josie was involved as, in a sense, Bob was her meal ticket, and she was unlikely to take steps to eliminate that possible stream of cash flow. While Josie was considered a person of interest, there didn't appear to be any evidence to link her to the disappearance. Interestingly, interviews with other family members map out a bizarre series of suggestions. Firstly, Julie was present at the home on Tuesday morning and spoke with a reporter. During this interview, she stated that her husband found the house empty when he returned from a store sometime between noon and 1 p.m., though we know from the police timeline that this is actually supposed to be 3 p.m. Julie later states that her father had been missing for approximately 28 hours in an interview taking place at 1:50 p.m., which would suggest that Bob disappeared at approximately 10 a.m. the day before, despite Jeff's statements that he had seen Bob as late as 2:30. Julie also mentions to the reporter that her father was showing early signs of dementia, which is something that has been repeated by her sisters. In several interviews, one or all point out that Bob was experiencing short-term memory loss, seemed to struggle when dealing with basic bills and paperwork, and that he was easily flustered and upset due to his struggle in these areas. At the same time, when authorities spoke with Bob's doctor, he told a different story, explaining that not only was Bob cognitively of sound mind, but that he was by far the healthiest 81-year-old he'd ever had as a patient. Some began to wonder if it were possible that someone was trying to paint the picture of Bob perhaps not being capable of making his own decisions, which becomes even more interesting when it's noted that someone, though it's never been revealed who, mentioned to the police that Bob may have regretted his whirlwind marriage to Fontel and perhaps had gone off somewhere to clear his mind. On Wednesday, July 29th, authorities speculated that Bob may have gone somewhere on his own following that cold feet theory. While they were concerned, it was their belief that Bob might still show up. After speaking with family members and canvassing the neighborhood, police were able to note that the last sighting of Bob was approximately 2:30 p.m. by his son-in-law. After that time, there were no reports of Bob's whereabouts. Neighbors described Bob as a kind man, but a reclusive one who wasn't actively involved in socializing. While police report that Bob appeared to have not had many friends in the area, at least one man disagreed, stating that he had been Bob's neighbor up until recent times and he and Bob were extremely friendly and close. Their next step was to go through Bob's house and look for any signs of what may have happened. Police have been hesitant to report much about the search of the home and to this day do not wish to share details about what they found or did not find. All we know for sure is that, upon inspection of the home, the only items of Bob's that appeared to be missing were his wallet and keys. Strangely, Bob wore required prescription glasses, and these were left behind. They did find handwritten notes inside the home, apparently scribed by Bob, noting plans to add Fontel's name to multiple accounts, though due to his disappearance, these steps were never taken. In Bob's car, again, they found little if anything to note a crime, though they did locate a handwritten address in the glove box, which when tracked, belonged to old friends of Bob's. Hoping that he may have gone there, Placentia police paid a visit to the couple, though they hadn't seen Bob recently, even though they did say he had brought Fontel by when she was in town. While Bob's family argued that he was having memory issues, they also said he wasn't great at driving at night and that he avoided the freeways. However, when authorities visited the friends from the handwritten address, they noted that one would almost certainly have to take the freeway to get there. The 29th just also happened to be the day that Fontel was set to arrive, and when she landed at the airport, she was quickly swarmed by members of the media looking for information about Bob's disappearance. Fontel knew very little of the case at the time and simply expressed concern for Bob and her eagerness to see him returned home. When she arrived at Bob's house, she was greeted by Julie and Paula. While Fontel entered the home, this was apparently going to be the first of what would become a bitter dispute between Fontel and her husband's family in regard to the home, assets, and everything else that belonged to Bob. By Friday, July 31st, authorities were absolutely confounded. Detective Corinne Loomis of the Placentia Police Department, when speaking to the media, expressed that their concern had grown in the past 48 hours. Detective Loomis explained, quote, "My personal sense was that if he did not return home by dark Wednesday night, we have a big problem. We didn't ramp up a serious investigation in hopes that he would come home yesterday. That was the breaking point." End quote. At that time, authorities were still stating that they believed this to be a missing persons case with no indications of foul play, but that perspective wouldn't last long. Missing persons flyers were created and put around town, including on Bob's house, and the media ran a steady stream of coverage about Bob's disappearance, though despite this spotlight, there were few, if any, tips. On Friday, August 7th, 11 days after Bob had disappeared, his daughters filed a petition to receive conservatorship over the estate. The daughters explained that they did this in order to be given access to funds to create a reward, pay bills, maintain the house, as well as to reimburse Fontel for her travel and shipping expenses. Reportedly, in response, Fontel moved into the home and had the locks changed. Fontel will later explain that Bob's daughters confronted her about living in the home and told her that she would need to vacate the premises. Fontel refused, arguing that not only was she married to Bob and this was half her home, but she had nowhere else to go after having moved across the country. Bob's daughters, on the other hand, have argued they never tried to evict Fontel. Fontel would later file her own legal documents fighting for control of the estate. At the initial ruling, the judge sided with Fontel. On Tuesday, August 18th, with no developments and very little to go on, authorities officially entered Bob's case into NAMIS, the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. They'd already begun monitoring Bob's bank accounts, credit cards, social security number, and other personal details, though there was no action on any of them following his disappearance. Bank records showed no large withdrawals prior to his disappearance, and it was believed if Bob had gone off on his own, there would likely have been some indication of his whereabouts by now. Later in the month, the Placentia Police Department performed multiple records checks on phones connected to individuals involved in the case, though further details regarding this have never been shared. Detective Loomis also shared with the media that Bob did not own a cell phone and therefore they could not track it. While authorities couldn't really pin down much of a motive on who would want to harm Bob, their case slowly began changing from that of a missing person to a likely homicide. It was during an investigation into Bob's finances that a possible motive was uncovered. According to records, Bob had accumulated an estate valued at nearly $5 million. According to everyone, even his own family, they did not know the full extent of his wealth. Fontel confessed her surprise at learning this detail, as did Detective Loomis. It appeared that, while Bob had always appeared to have been financially stable, he was far beyond that. This brings up two distinct possibilities in the minds of investigators, that Fontel could have been involved in hopes of acquiring all of Bob's wealth, or perhaps that Bob's own children may have done something to stop Fontel from getting her hands on any of the estate which would go to them if Bob died. When authorities dug into these two theories, they found one far more likely than the other. In the case of Fontel, it simply didn't make a great deal of sense. She didn't have her name added to anything of value at the time. She was halfway across the country when Bob disappeared, and if she were simply in it for the money, she'd likely have waited until Bob signed some things over to her before she eliminated him. On the other hand, it seemed rather clear that there had been many disputes between Bob and his children in regard to their trust and the estate. And so the idea that a family member could have been involved wasn't all that far-fetched, and money is the oldest motive in the world. In what can only be called a bizarre statement, one of Bob's grandsons, to whom he'd allegedly loaned hundreds of thousands of dollars, stopped making payments on the loan, explaining that the agreement stipulated that the debt would be erased upon Bob's death. Over the course of the next few years, the family found itself tied up in multiple legal battles. Bob's grandson was apparently told he would need to pay back the estate what he had borrowed, though that didn't appear to happen. Josie and her husband were confronted and told they needed to pay back what Josie owed the estate. Beyond that, the family fought bitterly against Fontel, who they essentially cut off and refused to speak with while trying to find a way to get her removed from their father's home. It's important to note that there is bitterness on both sides of the argument, with Fontel accusing the family of trying to force her out, and the family accusing Fontel of disposing of some of Bob's belongings and removing missing persons flyers. Trying to find the truth in the middle of that drama is nearly impossible, and investigators agreed. 5 years after Bob had last been seen, in 2014, members of his family petitioned the court to have him declared legally dead. This motion, which was ultimately granted, gave the estate to Bob's children, and all assets which belonged to that estate were theirs, including the home that Fontel had been living in. After 5 years of living there and waiting for Bob's return, while growing less and less optimistic about it, Fontel was ordered to exit the premises by court order, as the home now belonged to Bob's children. In the nearly 10 years since Bob was last seen, there have been no major developments in his case. The Placentia police have expressed their frustration with it, both in terms of not having a clue as to what may have happened, and also in terms of trying to work with the family, who they have described as being involved in a feud with Bob over money, and thus the veracity of their statements can't be fully verified. Josie, who was once considered a person of interest in the case, was later ruled out, leaving authorities with no official suspects. Police have, however, been outspoken about the fact that they do not believe Bob left of his own accord, nor do they believe that this was a random incident involving a stranger. When asked for an update, Chief Anderson replied, quote, I don't want to show my hand to you. We have a couple of ongoing roads we're going to go down. I don't want to alert possible suspects. We have nothing to focus on directly, yet. End quote. For some, this has become a case of utter confusion with little to no information available to explain what could possibly have happened. And for others, it's a story that's been heard so many times before when greed works its way into the lives of a family and disputes about finances begin to take place, especially with a new person coming into the picture to complicate matters further. In the absence of real information, two theories have been suggested to try and fill in the blanks of this incredibly mystifying case. The first theory argues that Bob's disappearance could be linked to his new wife, Fontelle, and that in the end of all things, his absence may have been necessary in order to supply her with the financial security she craved. The second theory puts the target on Bob's own family, suggesting that his disappearance may have been linked entirely to his estate. During a time when the whole family seemed to be embroiled in a bitter feud over the trust, it's a bizarre coincidence that right when Bob had showed them the trust and allegedly expressed his interest in bringing Fontelle into the fold, he disappeared just the next day before he could do anything to legally change who had rights to his assets. Bob Harrod was last seen sometime on the morning of July 27, 2009. Depending on what timeline you follow, he was either last seen as early as 11 a.m. or as late as 2:30 p.m. When last seen, Bob was described as being a Caucasian male with thinning gray hair and blue-gray eyes. Bob stands 5 feet 11 inches tall and weighs approximately 170 pounds. Bob was last seen wearing white shorts, a white V-neck undershirt, white socks pulled up to his knees, a white belt, white hat, and white Reebok sneakers. There is a plain gold wedding band on his left ring finger, and there may be a Masonic ring with a red stone on his right ring finger. Bob is required to wear glasses, though they were left behind. Bob was last seen in the 500 block of Carnation Drive in Placentia, California, and if alive today, would be 90 years old. In a life full of twists and turns, Bob Harrod may finally have found his storybook ending. It's something like out of a Hollywood movie, two people coming back together after nearly 60 years apart. And yet, before he could walk into the sunset with Fontelle, the 81-year-old disappeared. Unfortunately, in the decades since, Bob has remained missing and justice has remained elusive, but more time may reveal the truth of what really became of Bob and who was responsible. The disappearance of Bob Harrod is a different type of case from the ones I usually address. Yes, it's an unexplained disappearance, but at the same time, this one feels sort of different when it comes to the selection of theories. There's really only two things here that investigators have ever really considered possible, and both revolve around whether or not someone close to Bob could be the one responsible for his disappearance and what is assumed to be his death. An 81-year-old man who worked hard, raised a family, was a devoted husband and father, mysteriously vanishes the day after discussing finances with his family, and 2 days before his new wife, his first love, comes to live with him. How incredibly tragic. This also happens to be a case where the concept of a random incident or stranger-related crime has basically been ruled out. Normally, I'd address this theory, but nothing points that way. The house wasn't in bad shape, aside from Bob's bed. There were no signs of a struggle, no indications that anything happened within the walls of the house. When Agnes arrived at the home, she found the doors securely locked. All that was missing were Bob's wallet and keys. No money had been taken out of his accounts, there was no activity on his credit cards, and nothing of value was taken from the home. If Bob had been ushered out of his home by a stranger, it's unlikely he'd have taken his wallet and keys with him. If he'd been taken by someone, would they have locked the doors behind them? No, it certainly appears that whatever led to Bob's disappearance was not something he saw coming, and he likely willingly went along with the person who would turn out to be his murderer. Another angle, one which has been mostly put forward by members of Bob's family, was that the elderly man may have been suffering from the onset of dementia. While this is certainly a possibility, it could have led Bob to wander out of his home, get lost, and who knows. However, there are reasons why this has, for the most part, been disregarded. Firstly, Bob's doctor disagreed about the state of mind and argued that Bob was quite aware and capable. Secondly, considering the amount of media coverage this case received and the fact that the coverage began within 24 hours of his disappearance, it seems unlikely that no one would have noticed him. A lot of times when someone suffering from dementia wanders off, they end up in a public location, standing in traffic or a parking lot, somewhere where people notice. Bob didn't live in the middle of nowhere, and not a single person reported seeing him after 2:30 p.m. Not a single sighting. That seems to make it pretty unlikely that he just wandered off. So now that we've discussed the two angles that most investigators have ruled out, that leaves us with the two that are still ruled in. The first of these possibilities is that Fontelle, the woman who came back into Bob's life unexpectedly, may have played a role in his disappearance. To really understand this theory, you have to remember that Fontelle and Bob's children do not by any means get along, and so while she pointed towards them, they all pointed towards her. It isn't as though this theory is from out of left field, though. We know that, in the recent past, Bob had been manipulated by a woman he felt something for, and that manipulation cost a large sum of money over a short period of time. It's difficult not to imagine someone marrying a much older man in such a rapid series of events could be seeking a fortune. There are, however, several problems with this theory. Fontelle alleges that she had no idea how much money Bob's estate was worth. While that could be a lie, it seems highly probable since even his children claim not to have known. If Bob didn't tell his children, why would he tell her? In addition to that, this would put us under the bizarre assumption that the entire romance was a ruse designed for Fontelle to get her hands on Bob's money, but again, how would she have known he had money? They hadn't seen one another for nearly 60 years. They'd had no contact during that time, and obviously Fontelle wasn't technologically skilled enough to be doing online searches about him. It's also exceedingly unlikely that in their first conversation, Bob would have just started talking about his money. That seems to be something he generally didn't do. When Fontelle arrived in California for the visit, what indication would she have had that Bob had money to try and get her hands on? He didn't live in an overly luxurious house. He didn't drive a fancy car or wear expensive clothes. His house wasn't decked out with all manner of pricey electronics and furniture. When Bob proposed to her, they didn't go to some expensive jeweler. They went to Sam's Club and chose extremely basic bands for one another. There's very little here which seems to suggest that Fontelle was digging for gold. Bob proposed 6 days into her visit and also asked her to extend her stay. As far as we know, Fontelle was set to go home, but Bob didn't want that. He wanted her back in his life. To what degree this had to do with his old feelings, new love, or simply his sadness and loneliness, we can't know for sure. But this was obviously not a guy who could be pushed into something. Hell, his kids tried with the trust and he just shut them out. Sure, Josie used him, but it seems like Bob knew that was happening and let it happen anyway. For argument's sake, let's explore this possibility from the angle that Fontelle concocted a scheme either before, after, or during her visit with Bob to get him out of the picture so she could get her hands on his money. Well, a 73-year-old woman in a state she didn't live in would somehow have to find someone who could carry out this crime without being caught and without leaving behind any evidence. We've already discussed that a random stranger incident isn't likely, so how the hell would she have pulled this off? As far as I've read, none of Bob's close friends or family members were hitmen for hire, so that seems pretty complicated. Not to mention that Fontelle didn't exactly come from a house of great means, so unless she found a contract killer who was willing to work on the promise of payment later, this seems pretty unlikely. Of course, there is something else to consider here. A woman decides she's going to get married just so she can bump off her husband and claim his estate. Yeah, that's happened before and sadly happens more often than not. The question really is, what does this woman have to do before she executes that plan? Well, it seems pretty obvious that the first thing she'd do isn't sure that her name had been added to the accounts, the deed for the house, the estate, and Bob's will before making any rash decisions about murder. Fontelle didn't do any of that. Her name was on nothing. She didn't have access to any of Bob's money, and honestly, if she had just waited to get her name on those accounts, she'd have had access to the money. She wouldn't even need to kill Bob to get her hands on it, unless it was what she wanted to do. Even if Bob adjusted his will, it seems unlikely he'd have left everything to his new wife and just abandoned his children. Following Bob's disappearance, Fontelle moved into the home they were meant to share and lived there for 5 years before she was forced out. We don't know the specifics, but obviously there's bad blood between her and Bob's children, so everything they say about one another has to be taken with a grain of salt. But from everything I've seen, Fontelle didn't walk out of that house carrying gold bars and getting into a fancy car. By all accounts, she didn't walk out with much of anything, and if indeed she was just a gold digger, it seems probable she'd have sold some of the things in the home to pull in some cash, so why didn't she? While money plays an important role in all of our lives, some people aren't willing to go to dark places to get more of it. Fontelle doesn't seem like she was trying to benefit in any way, other than arguing, and perhaps rightfully so, that as Bob's lawful wife, she had a right to live in that house. While the Fontelle theory is one which has to be addressed, when you look at everything we know about the case, there really isn't much to support it. Remember, Fontelle is the one who filed the missing persons report. She has spoken with the media countless times, given interviews, made pleas for Bob's return. Hell, some of his own children have barely spoken to the media. If Fontelle was responsible for this crime, she's done a really poor job of distancing herself from it and trying to protect her secret. Fontelle has even said on several occasions that she believes something happened to Bob and that it might have taken place in his bathroom. What leads her to believe this, we can't know for sure, but in terms of evidence, outside of Bob's children's opinions, there is nothing that points to Fontelle. So, if it wasn't Fontelle, who else does that leave? Well, the second and final theory of this case turns the focus the other way and targets Bob's family. It's difficult to get an idea of what type of people Bob's children are. They haven't exactly been represented favorably in the press, and even on this episode, I've sort of had to slant them because that's all the information that's available. I try my best not to be biased, but this is a situation where I don't really have a choice about it. Even Roberta has acknowledged that the media has made her family seem like monsters. So let's try it a little differently, and let's throw all of that out. Forget about opinions and rumors, dismiss what Fontelle thinks about the family and what the family thinks about her. Let's just do exactly what you're supposed to do when you're investigating a case. Let's let the evidence fit the case rather than making the case fit the evidence. In order to do that, we need to break down what we know for certain about this case, which honestly shouldn't take very long. All information we have about Bob on the day of his disappearance comes from two distinct sources: his son-in-law Jeff and his daughter Roberta. Roberta claims that she called her father that morning and spoke to him. She says she heard Jeff in the background commenting that he needed to go to the hardware store. This call is believed to have taken place between 11 a.m. and 12 p.m., though police know the exact time. Jeff, in turn, says that Bob was present in the house and seemed to be in good spirits. It wasn't until Jeff came back, sometime after 3 p.m., that Bob was missing. Agnes, the housekeeper, was there waiting to be let inside. So assuming these accounts are accurate, Bob disappeared sometime between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. We know for some of that window of time, based on receipts and surveillance footage, that Jeff was at Home Depot. The receipt clearly states the purchase time as being 3:04. That leaves a pretty large window open, though. Basically any time from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. A forensics team swept through Jeff's truck and didn't find anything that would signify that a crime had been committed. However, I find it interesting that the police commented once about how finding Bob's DNA in the truck wouldn't set off any red flags, as he was a family member and would likely have been in that truck at some point in time. Well, that doesn't exactly rule out the possibility of Bob having been driven somewhere, believing he was going somewhere else, and at this remote location, he could have been murdered. Imagine someone Bob trusts asking him to come along, say, I don't know, to a hardware store, and instead, driving him someplace where he was murdered. That's purely speculative, but it's not impossible. Based on the condition of the house, the absence of any evidence of a struggle, and a total lack of any forensic evidence, authorities don't believe that Bob was attacked inside of his home, nor do they believe he was forced out of it. This would mean that whoever Bob encountered that day was someone he felt safe with and trusted. Bob took his wallet and keys with him, left behind his glasses, and locked the door behind him. Or perhaps someone else locked the door to bar entry to someone who might arrive later, like a maid. Either way, Bob seems to have willingly gone along with the person who may have been responsible for his disappearance, and there aren't exactly a ton of people on that list of possibilities. If indeed Jeff's timeline is correct, that means that someone either got lucky enough to take Bob before Jeff returned, or they were watching the house and waiting for an opportunity. Of course, there's always the possibility that someone was told a specific time to commit the crime, but we really don't know. All that we do know is that by the time Agnes arrives, Bob is gone. Whoever committed the crime had to have planned it and known exactly what he or she wanted to do. There had to be steps in place and a procedure organized. This wasn't random. So really, perhaps, the best way to try and determine what could have happened to Bob is to look at motive. In this case, the motive is pretty clearly money. A nearly $5 million estate that was at risk of having another piece of its pie cut away and given to Fontel. There had already been disputes in the family over the trust account, and we've already read that at least one of Bob's grandchildren owed him a large sum of money, though what exactly went on there has never been accounted for. Is it possible that someone in Bob's own family could have committed this crime in order to secure their piece of the estate? Well, sadly, yes. While it seems horrendous to imagine, family members have killed each other for far less than $5 million in the past. One detail I find fascinating is that, while the family have united and stated that they do not believe any member of the family was responsible for Bob's disappearance, they did put a clause in their $50,000 reward which specified that the reward could not be claimed by a family member. Why put that in there if there's no possibility that a family member was involved or knows more than they have told authorities? Several things stick out to a lot of people who have looked at this case, primarily that it was Fontel who filed the missing persons report and not one of Bob's children, despite having called Fontel and told her they didn't know where their father was. Beyond that, when Bob wasn't answering his phone, rather than stopping by to check on him, they called the police to do a welfare check. Finally, for a man whose estate was valued at nearly $5 million, a lot of people think that a $50,000 reward is, quite frankly, low. That's 1% of the total value of the estate, give or take a few hundred thousand. Police have been pretty open about the fact that if a member of the family was involved and others have stood in to protect and lie for them, there's a slim chance they're ever going to crack this case. If it's a united front and nobody wants to turn on anyone else, there's little law enforcement can do. I've watched interviews with Paula and Roberta. I've read comments from them in the papers. They are adamant that they do not know what happened to their father and that they do not believe a member of the family was responsible. Julie, Jeff's wife, hasn't participated much in conversations with the media outside of the first few days following Bob's disappearance. Some people look at that as a sign of guilt, but we also have to keep in mind that her father disappeared, so maybe it's just something she finds too painful to talk about. There's been all sorts of angles to this theory passed around, from an outright plot to murder Bob before he could sign Fontel's name to any documents, to a massive argument that resulted in Bob having a heart attack or some other health issue, which ultimately led to his death and was covered up out of fear. There's really no way to know, and without enough information or answers, all we can do is find what evidence we can and use that to take our best guess. In ancient Rome, when trying to determine who committed a crime, they always asked one question: qui bono, who benefits? When you look at Bob's disappearance, there's a pretty stark difference between these two theories. In one, a woman sells her home, packs up her belongings, and moves across the country, only to find her new husband is gone, and a few years later she's forced out of that home and on her own. In the other, a family who had heated arguments with Bob about money, trusts, and basically their inheritance, ends up with everything. The full estate, the house, the assets, it all comes with them when Bob is officially declared dead. which seems like more of a motive to you. A motive doesn't necessarily make a crime, but you don't get a lot of crimes without a motive. In the end, this is a case which, sadly, I don't think is likely to be solved anytime soon. Police were essentially handicapped from the beginning and being fed information on both sides that directed them all over the place. Between the fighting of the families versus Fontelle to the theories about Bob's state of mind or the possibility of cold feet, where were they supposed to begin? An utter lack of physical evidence absolutely hindered things, and while the Placentia police did the best they could, despite criticism to the contrary, they basically were trying to solve a crime when every person around them might have had a reason to conceal or distort the truth. July 27th of this year will mark 10 years that Bob has been missing. In that time, investigators have remained fairly quiet, and any tips or information that have been given have not seemed to have led anywhere. For a man who lived 81 years and at the end reunited with a woman he had once loved so dearly, it's a truly bitter and tragic ending. Sadly, Bob's disappearance remains an open case, although at this time it is considered a possible homicide. Unless someone comes forward with new information, some piece of evidence is discovered, or someone confesses, the disappearance of Bob Harrod remains open, unsolved, and very cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Bob Harrod, there are many news articles and forums discussing his case. The television series Disappeared also ran an episode on Bob's disappearance. If you have any information about the disappearance of Bob Harrod, please contact the Placentia Police Department at area code 714-993-8164. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. This year, CrimeCon will be held in New Orleans from June 7th through the 9th. Amidst exciting presentations and inspiring discussions, I'm really looking forward to attending and representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend but haven't yet purchased your pass, you can save 10% by using the promo code TRACE19. Simply visit CrimeCon.com, select a standard pass, and use the code TRACE19. That's TRACE19 to save 10% today. I look forward to seeing you there. A special shout out goes to Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Tara Doble, and Tom Archer. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row and can't wait to meet all of you. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.